first case today is 11-1775, United States v. Jason Wayne Plew, and 11-1782, In re Jason Wayne Plew.
Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Claire Richards, representing Governor Lincoln D. Chafee, the Governor of Rhode Island. May it please the Court. The United States, Rhode Island, and 47 other states are parties to the Interstate Agreement on Detainers Act. This act is an interstate compact, it is an act of Congress, and it is a binding contract between the parties who are signatories to it. The United States comes to this Court today to rewrite one provision of the act. That provision permits a governor of a custodial state to refuse a request to transfer a prisoner in its custody. The governor of Rhode Island, supported by the National Governors Association, which represents the 50 governors of all 50 states, and the Council on State Governments, which played an integral role in drafting the interstate agreement, come to this court today to urge the court to enforce the express terms of the Detainers Act and to uphold the governor's right to refuse a prisoner transfer request from any member state, including the United States. We urge this for three reasons. The first is the special interpretive regime governing the interstate compacts. This regime prohibits the court from rewriting the terms of a compact unless the provisions are unconstitutional. There is nothing unconstitutional about the disapproval provision of the Detainers Act. The second reason is that even ordinary rules of statutory construction require that the Detainers Act be read as a limitation on the power and reach of the habeas statute, which is the other statute at play in this case. And third, we urge this court to uphold the governor's disapproval provision because the United States Supreme Court in Morrow positively dictates that the United States be bound by all of the terms of the Detainer Act, including the gubernatorial refusal provision.
Ms. Clare, the United States in their brief and also the dissent in the panel opinion is of the view that Morrow favors their viewpoint. What do you have to say about that?
To that, Your Honor, I would say that I think 95% of Morrow is extremely clear that the governor is right on this issue. Morrow has said that the United States is a full party, both as a sending and receiving state, with no judicial exceptions, that once a detainer is filed, the United States must comply with all of the terms of the agreement, and that the United States cannot get the advantages of the Detainer Act without assuming the Act's obligations and responsibilities.
What about the other 5%?
Morrow has also construed a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum issued after a detainer to be not a writ, but instead a written request. At the 5% of Morrow that is, I think, somewhat disturbing to the dissent and to my brother from the United States is the portion of Morrow that is really what I would call dicta or conditional language. And that portion of Morrow says, if states never had the right to dishonor a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum, the IAD does not give them that right. And that is, I think, a disturbing passage to some of the other judges and attorneys in this room. But I would say three things about that passage. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, another passage of Morrow specifically says that the writ issued after a detainer is no longer a writ. Instead, it is a written request, which may be dishonored under the IAD. The second thing is that I think the language itself is conditional. It does not say whether states did or did not have the right to disapprove a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum. And I believe that that issue is an open question The question was left open in a case called Carbo, decided in 1960, and cited in both the defendant's brief and in the governor's brief at footnote 20. And the question was not definitively answered in Morrow. It was left open.
What about footnote 28?
Footnote 28 in Morrow specifically references two provisions of committee reports leading up to the passage of the IAD. And there the footnote says that the IAD preserves a governor's right to refuse. And, quote, a governor's right to refuse to make the prisoner available on public policy grounds is retained. So that footnote and other language in Morrow presupposes that at the time of the passage of the IAD, the governor did have the right to, or state officials had the right to refuse to honor a writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum. The Supreme Court has not, I don't believe, directly addressed that point. And I don't believe that it's necessary for this court to address the point, because I think what Morrow does is it turns the writ from an order of the court, it sort of demotes it down to a just plain old written request. So I'm not sure that the court has to address that issue even in this case. But if the court is inclined to address that issue, I think that there is some indication in the historical record and the cases cited in the governor's brief that historically, prior to 1970, states did honor the writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum as a matter of comity and not by compulsion. I've cited those cases in our brief, Oliver, McDonald, U.S. ex rel. Moses, Gordon, Perez, and there are numerous other cases to the same extent.
Well, Carbo itself speaks in terms of comity.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Carbo itself speaks in terms of comity.
Yes, it does, Your Honor. That's right. And I also think in this area there has been an evolution in the law over, you know, from sort of maybe the 1940s to the present. And one way that you can look at that evolution of the law is to look at a case like Puerto Rico versus Branstad, which in 1987 decided that states did not have the right to refuse a request for extradition by another state. But that was in 1987. For the prior 125 years, the law was, even though there was a direct constitutional mandate requiring states to hand over a prisoner who was a fugitive within their state to another state, there was nothing compelling states to do that. And for that reason, they honored that constitutional provision as a matter of comity and not as a matter of compulsion. Now, Branstad changed all that, but the fact remains this was the backdrop against which the 1970 Detainers Agreement was enacted. And so in 1970, at least, we don't have to decide whether it's the case today, but in 1970 at least, it was an open question about the level to which states were required to comply with these writs, whether it was their compliance was as a matter of comity or by compulsion. I think that is much more settled today than it was in 1970.
Do you believe, as your opponent has raised, that Branstad trumps the case, the situation here?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why?
Branstad was a specific constitutional requirement that states turn over a fugitive. There is no such constitutional requirement here. It has to do with the extradition clause. It does not have to do with a specific agreement among the states and the United States transfer prisoners in their custody. That dealt with fugitives. It's a different case. I only raise it to show the evolution of the law since, you know, the 1860s to today in terms of the Supremacy Clause. If there are no further questions, I think I'll rest on the brief. Thank you very much.
You indicated that 47 states are participants.
Yes, Your Honor.
What are the three states that have chosen not to join? Do you know?
I think I recently had a nightmare that that question would be asked, and I have failed to determine which ones are non-joining states. I'm sorry.
But at any rate, in those jurisdictions, there's no detainer issue, and the United States simply proceeds by virtue of their writ.
I do not know how the United States proceeds in those states, Your Honor. Thank you.
I'm sorry. You just raised a question in my mind that I think the answer is, but I would like to hear from you. The state of Rhode Island is not challenging the right of the government of the United States to seek production of the prisoner by a writ of habeas corpus without having filed a detainer. Am I correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. We are not. If the United States had not issued a detainer, but instead had gone directly to the writ, we would not be here today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Mann.
Good morning. I represent Jason Plew. Our position has been supported by an amicus brief filed on behalf of a number of civil liberties groups, criminal defense organizations, and the Puerto Rico Bar Association. Your Honors, it is our position that the United States has a choice when it seeks the custody of a state prisoner for the purposes of federal prosecution. It may elect to use a writ of habeas corpus ad prosecutandum, or it may elect to proceed by lodging a detainer and using the interstate agreement on detainers. The federal government has that choice. It can use one or the other. Once it elects to use the interstate agreement on detainers, as it did in this case, it is bound by the terms of that agreement, one of which includes the right of a governor of the sending state to refuse to turn a prisoner over. I have two primary points.
Counsel, I'd just like to ask you a question about that. Intervenor counsel, I think, made the same statement and said we wouldn't be here today had the government elected to proceed under the writ process. And I know the panel opinion says that there's an election to be made. I have a practical concern. You know that in the government's petition for rehearing, it states to the effect that there are sort of procedural problems that would be involved in setting up a writ process. I've got another concern, and I'd like to hear your response to it, and that is wouldn't that create a real disincentive for the federal government to ever comply with the IAD? And the disincentive would be even much more powerful the more controversial the policy split between the federal interests and the state interest. That seems to me to be not very sensible. So what's your reaction?
Well, I have a few. First is that, I mean, I understand the specter of the fact that the governor having the power to refuse to turn somebody over might open up the floodgates. But everybody seems to agree that this is the first case since the passage of the interstate agreement in which a governor has declined to turn somebody over to the federal authorities. So I don't think that you would have that sort of floodgate of problems.
Well, I don't understand that. If this case, as written by the panel, remains, I mean, if I'm a United States attorney, I think it's inevitable that as part of the decision whether to seek an indictment, I'm going to be considering the federal interest. Presumably, I'm not going to indict unless I think there's a federal interest. I'm just going to proceed by a writ.
And my response to you. Your Honor, do this. I think you're sort of asking me as a practical matter, how is this going to play out, if I understand you?
Yes.
And you
have said that the government has an election.
Right. And I would say to you, as a practical matter, Your Honor, I don't think that ruling the way we ask you to rule is going to have a large impact on how the United States government prosecutes cases. As a practical matter, I think there are a tiny, tiny number of cases where a governor might intercede. And the best evidence of that, I would say to you, is that over the last 40 years, we've seen, as far as we all know, only one case in which a governor has interceded. I agree that it might be the situation that in certain cases that almost everybody can identify from the start, certain high-profile cases, certain cases with sort of litmus test-type issues, it might become a question. And I suppose in those cases, the United States attorney might think, do I want to go by means of a detainer, or do I want to go by means of a writ of habeas corpus ad prosecutum?
So I just have one more question on this. Do you think that Congress would have contemplated that to be the lay of the land at the end of this?
When they passed this act in 1970, Your Honor, as Ms. Richards pointed out, I think at least the practice was that there were a number of instances, certainly not all, but a number of instances in which states had refused to turn over prisoners and request a federal request. They also had refused to turn over prisoners and request a request from other states. That option was effectively eliminated by Branstad, okay? And I accept that with respect to state-to-state requests. With respect to the federal request, the response to your answer, I think, is this. I'm not sure the legislative history everybody agrees is pretty slim. The Congress specifically contemplated that. It is true that when the act was introduced, the Deputy Attorney General Kleindienst was one of the individuals who went before Congress and basically asked for this act to be passed. The Attorney General's office was an active participant in the solicitation of the passage of the Interstate Agreement on Detainers Act. But I can't say to you that there's any place in the congressional record where Congress reflects a contemplation of this particular result. But I go back to what I think. But I do think that the question you raise about how this all plays out, when you look at the historical travel of this, and I think that also goes to the so-called part of the Morrow case that everybody finds a little bit troubling, the passage where they talk about how we don't purport to augment a governor's power with respect to their ability to refuse or decline to honor or habeas corpus ad prosecutendum. I think that's the passage that everybody finds troubling. I think I want to address it because I think it's a sequel to your question. There are two responses to that. First, I think what the court was saying was a writ of habeas corpus ad prosecutendum, if it's issued after a detainer has been lodged, is no longer construed as a writ of habeas corpus ad prosecutendum. At that point, it's construed as a written request under the interstate agreement, and therefore, we're not saying you have some special power. We're saying it's a written request, and under the Detainer Act, the United States is a party just like all the other states are. In fact, it's so clear that they're a party that we name the Attorney General as the equivalent of the governor to function in that capacity. But the second part of that response is this. Carver gets decided, I think it is, in 1960. Then you have the agreement passed in 1970. You have the agreement passed in 1970. And then you have Morrow passed in 1978. When Morrow was passed in 1978, the footnote 20 in Carbo has still never been resolved. This is before Branstad has been decided, which comes in 1987. The lay of the land is that at least it appears that jurisdictions have the right to refuse to honor a request for a writ of habeas corpus. At least as a matter of practice, they do both state to state and state to federal. So, when they say we don't augment the power, they're not defining what the power of a governor is. It remains at that point, I submit to you, fairly undefined. The footnote in Carbo, and then ultimately the decision in Branstad, which reverses what had been a long-standing practice. So I think you can explain, I think it's a further response to your question that's the explanation for that passage, I think, in Morrow. Now, I think that Morrow, except for that passage, which I've tried to address, is totally supportive of the position of Mr. Plew. Morrow says the United States is a signatory to this agreement. The act itself makes the United States a signatory to the agreement. As I've already indicated, the United States was one of the parties who advanced this agreement. As recounted in the legislative history, the United States was part of the whole build-up to the passage of this agreement. They were party to some of the meetings by the Council of State Governments. That's in one of the amicus briefs. So the United States was a long-time participant in the passage of this interstate agreement. Morrow emphasizes that they're a full-scale party. There is no carve-out with respect to the limitation of the United States. Now, what does happen is, sometime after the interstate agreement is passed, in 1988, a year after Branstad, Congress does amend the interstate agreement. And when they amend the interstate agreement at that point, they create two exceptions for how the United States is going to be treated as opposed to all the other signatories. significantly, they don't create a carve-out for the United States with respect to the governor's exception at that point. So it's not as if Congress was unaware of their ability to put the United States in a different position than other parties with respect to the interstate agreement. And one of those carve-outs was very significant. It dealt with the consequences of a speedy trial dismissal under the interstate agreement.
Why isn't it an answer to that position to say that while the United States government may be required to comply with the provisions, the real question here is the governor's authority? And why wouldn't the answer to that be that the Supremacy Clause requires the governor to comply with the request?
And my answer to that would be you have two different federal statutes. It's not a Supremacy Clause issue. You have the writ of habeas corpus ad prosecutendum, which is grounded on federal statute, and the interstate agreement, which is also a federal, now has the full force and effect of federal law. And so you basically have two competing federal statutes, and you try and interpret those two statutes in a way that will allow them both to have full force and effect. And the way you let them do that is that the writ of habeas corpus ad prosecutendum is preserved as long as the government does not invoke or trigger the interstate agreement. Once they trigger the interstate agreement, then that agreement is applies. Thank you.
Once more time.
Thank you, Mr. Mann. Mr. Lockhart.
Good morning. There are two key propositions here. The first is that prior to the IAD, it's clear that a state never had power to dishonor a federal habeas writ. The second proposition comes directly out of the Morrow passage that we rely upon, and that is that Article 4 of the IAD, the so-called disapproval clause, did not augment the state's power in that regard. So if the state never had the power to dishonor the federal habeas writ, and if Article 4 did not augment the state's power in any respect, it follows, as night day or day night, that a governor cannot invoke Article 4 in an effort to reject the writ.
Do you attach any significance to footnote 28?
We do. It has tremendous significance because what it points you to is the 1956 report of the Council on State Governments, one of the amici here. And if you look at page 79 of that report, the 1956 report, it says in reference to Article 4, quote, "The possibility is left open merely to accommodate situations involving public policy which occasionally have been found in the history of extradition." The key word in that sentence is extradition. This makes clear that when Article 4 was drafted, they had in mind some sort of vestigial, very fuzzy notion that somewhere in the extradition law tradition, states might have had power to refuse extradition demands by other states.
And that ties in with the Supreme Court in Morrow wasn't talking about extradition. It was talking about the AID.
Right.
IAD, I'm sorry.
It was, but the Supreme Court itself cited this proposition. And in the passage that we all are talking about, the Supreme Court said that, as the history of the provision makes clear, it was meant to do no more than preserve previously existing rights of the sending states.
That's exactly what footnote 28 says. It says, quote from it, "Both committee reports note that, quote, a governor's right to refuse to make a prisoner available is preserved." And then it goes on to say, "The State Council of State Governments, the Council of State Governments, which, as you have stated, is an amici in this case, discussed the previous provision in similar terms," quote, "a governor's right to refuse to make the prisoner available, parenthesis, on public policy grounds," which is exactly what the governor here has claimed, "is retained."
Right, but the only way to make sense of what the Supreme Court is talking about is to look at the actual report that it cites. That's the 1956 report.
It doesn't cite the rest of the report. It cites those specific words.
Well, there are two pages, 78 and 79, and the two statements come on those pages. And the key statement, we believe, is on page 79. And I've just read that statement. If you look at the amici brief filed by the Council of State Government, and if you look at the ACLU brief filed on behalf of the ACLU and 10 different entities, you'll notice that when they quote that sentence on page 79 of the 1956 report, they eliminate the key parts of the sentence that I just read to you. They omit the first part, which says the possibility is left open merely. They quote the next part, which is to accommodate situations involving public policy, and then they omit the last part of the sentence, which says, which occasionally have been found in the history of extradition. They don't want the court to focus.
I will continue to belabor this point because I have something else that I would like to ask you. I think, and frankly, I'm not familiar with the practicalities of this, and you are, and I would like your help on it. What is the downside, in practical terms, of you proceeding through a habeas corpus route rather than the detainer?
All right. Well, there's some confusion, I think, engendered by the original panel decision, which suggests incorrect.
It's been vacated. That's why we're here.
Which suggests incorrectly, we believe, that somehow the United States can avoid the IAD simply by going to the writ. The key issue is that once we have filed a detainer, the Supreme Court said in Morrow that any subsequent writ constitutes a written request for IAD purposes. So the IAD is implicated as soon as we have a detainer and a writ. The question presented here is whether the habeas writ stands outside of that process, okay, which is another way of stating our position. There's no question that the IAD is implicated, that the defendant has his anti-shuttling rights and his speedy trial rights, as soon as we, A, file a detainer, which we did here, and, B, we seek the writ. So the fact that in this case we initiated the process with the IAD written request and then went to the writ is really irrelevant. It's a red herring because the IAD written request and the habeas writ both, according to the Supreme Court in Morrow, constitute written requests. And as soon as you have a detainer and you have either of those two documents following, the IAD is implicated. But that just then begs the question that we're here to debate.
But I realize that, but I'm trying to follow up on the advice given to you by the Supreme Court in Morrow. It says basically that you would avoid all the problems that are raised in that case, and I would say in this case, not any longer, but if you had started from scratch or in future cases, by simply filing for a writ of habeas corpus, because that would not trigger the IAD.
It would if there were a detainer, and that's our point.
No, excuse me. What I am suggesting and what I would like to know from a practical standpoint, from your office's standpoint, from the U.S. government's standpoint, what is lost? How is life made more difficult, let's put it that way, by you having, instead of going and filing a detainer, you go and file for a habeas corpus. Now, one of the things I envision, I'm sorry, I'll give you an opportunity to answer this, but one of the things I envision is I assume that the U.S. Attorney's Office does speak to the state prosecutors in an informal manner, if nothing else, and I would assume that you would call up and say, we are interested in this prisoner. Will you turn him over to us, or do we have to file for a habeas corpus? And they say, no, you file for a habeas corpus.
Right. So you finally, I think, put your finger on the issue, which is that in order to avoid the IAD, we would need to not file a detainer. And so the question becomes, why don't we just take our chances, not file detainers, risks that people are going to get out of state prison because nobody's watching? That's the conundrum that we would find ourselves in that way. We would have to devise a new and potentially cumbersome system of keeping track of state inmate release dates, and defendants inevitably would argue that any new system that we devise is tantamount to a detainer. Defendants have made that. I mean, we could file a document with a state prison that's not called detainer. It's called, please keep the defendant, for us.
Any written request becomes a detainer.
Well, I
wasn't suggesting that.
Well, so in other words, you're saying why doesn't the government just take its chances on state inmates being released into the community? And it's not a chance that we're willing to take.
I'm sorry, what happens in those three states that aren't parties to the compact?
Well, I don't know. First of all, I don't know which three states those are, and I haven't had nightmares about that issue. And
counsel, isn't there another concern? The prisoner protections in the IAD would be lost under that system.
Well, that's certainly true. If the panel opinion were to stand, or if the en banc court were to adopt that as its decision in this case, then the government would have an incentive, at least in cases where the defendant's serving a long state prison term and there's somewhat less risk that the defendant will be let out, to not file detainers in those cases.
So why isn't that a paramount concern? I thought that was one of the fundamental reasons for the IAD, prisoner protection.
Oh, absolutely. So in that event, the defendant would lose two key benefits of the IAD. Number one, the anti-shuttling provision, which protects defendants from being sent back to the original place of incarceration before their trial is had in the receiving state.
So my question to you is the same one I had for Mr. Mann. Do you think that Congress would have contemplated that outcome when it passed the IAD?
No, I don't think Congress in its wildest dreams could have thought that it was ceding its rights under 2241, a basic right that's been around since 1789, in passing the IAD. It couldn't have been within their contemplation that they were giving up one of the basic tools that a district court needs to convene a trial in a federal criminal case.
My question is more limited.
Mm-hmm.
The prisoner protection purpose mm-hmm. of the statute, would Congress have contemplated that should be lost when it comes to the federal government?
No, of course not. The federal government's prosecutions represent presumably a decent chunk of prosecutions across the country, and it would make no sense to have an IAD system which gives benefits to state inmates but not to people entering the federal system.
Would you agree that the IAD is a compact within the meaning of the compact clause?
Sure.
All right, then are you familiar with the recent case decided last year or the year before by the Supreme Court of Alabama versus North Carolina?
No.
Well, let me just read something to you, and then you can comment on it. The Supreme Court said, "We are especially reluctant to read absent terms into an interstate compact, given the federalism and separation of powers concerns that would arise were we to rewrite an agreement among sovereign states, to which the political branches consented. As we have said before, we will not, quote, order relief inconsistent with the express terms of a compact, no matter what the equities or the circumstances might otherwise invite," end quote.
And our comment is that there's no need to even resort to rules of statutory construction here because the Supreme Court has spoken authoritatively on the issue, and therefore it would be inappropriate to analyze this case from first principles, as your question appears to be doing, citing rules of statutory constructions concerning interstate compacts.
But didn't the Supreme Court in that case, which you are relying on, the 95% of that case, let me refer to, says that you are a state and are bound by all of the provisions of that compact?
Yes, and in the very same breath, the Supreme Court said that Article 4 does not enhance a state's power to dishonor the writ. And so the Supreme Court clearly had...
And we have the reference to footnote 28.
Right, which we say supports our position because it refers you to the 1956 report of the Council of State Governments, which makes clear that this provision was meant to do no more than capture in amber whatever sort of vestigial right existed as between states to resist an extradition demand.
Thank you for your patience with my questions. You probably have other things you want to cover.
Well, I'm not sure I have anything more to say, frankly. I certainly won't belabor the points that I've made already in one on-bond petition.
On the footnote 28 issue, there seem to be two different arguments lurking, and I'd just like to be clear if you're making both of them. The first is that the footnote appears to be referring to extradition where two states are involved and not the federal government. Is that your reading of it, or are you arguing there is a larger reading that as against the federal government, and its traditional habeas power, no one ever contemplated that the residual power would include the power of a state governor on policy grounds to disagree with the policy choices made by the Congress and the executive branch.
It's really both points, Your Honor. Now, I guess there's only one other thing to mention, which is that in an attempt to rebut Judge Boudin's position that it is patent that a state has never had the authority to dishonor a federal writ, Mr. Plew and the governor do cite eight cases, new cases in their supplemental brief, seven circuit court cases, one district court cases, all from the period 1940s through the 1970s. And they say that these eight cases stand for the proposition that, in fact, states did have the right to dishonor the federal writ. Now, there are a couple things to note about those cases, and in the vein of being helpful to the extent you've read them or not read them, here are the main points that we have in response to those cases. Number one, none of them is a Supreme Court case, which is itself significant. Number two, none of these cases involved an actual litigated controversy between the United States and a state over enforcement of a federal writ. Number three, all of these cases get off on the wrong track by citing to Ponzi v. Fessenden, the 1922 Supreme Court decision, which speaks in general terms of comity and the desire that sovereigns cooperate together on prisoner transfers. But there is nothing in Ponzi which suggests even remotely that a state can dishonor a federal writ. And in fact, Ponzi involved the reverse situation where the state of Massachusetts got a state court to issue a state writ for a federal prisoner. The U.S. Attorney General agreed to that transfer. Ponzi complained. He said, "You don't have the power to release me from the exclusive jurisdiction of the United States." And the Supreme Court lost no time in saying that Mr. Ponzi had no right to interpose himself in that dispute. And that's one of the cases we rely upon, incidentally, for the proposition that Mr. Plew doesn't even have standing to be here. So these eight cases do not stand for any sort of consensus that prior to the IAED, the states had the power to dishonor the writ. So in conclusion, we would ask you to deny the governor's petition for a writ of prohibition. We would ask you to uphold the district court's writ of habeas corpus ad prosequendum, and we would ask you to allow our prosecution to go forward.
The court will stand in recess. It is our intention to have some time to discuss this case before the next case resumes. Our clerk's office has also asked that there be a break sufficient to accommodate those who want to exit and those who want to enter. I do think your reference to cooperative federalism has set the stage for what we will hear when we return.
Thank you.